Good evening. Good evening, everyone. That's not on. Hello, hello. Okay, give Jacob a sec here. Now it's on? Now it's on. Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Michael Duchesne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to tonight's lecture with Arthur Miller. Very pleased to welcome Arthur to Perimeter Institute. He is, however, a rather demanding lecture so far in Einstein Fest. Most of our lecturers have been quite content to have just a regular backdrop. Arthur demanded a set be built for his, complete with blackboard of a very particular size. Okay, of course, I'm kidding. We are now standing on the set of Picasso at the Lapin Agile by Steve Martin, a play that will open tomorrow night as part of Einstein Fest, 5 performances. And I believe there are still some tickets available for that play. If you'd like to come, go to einsteinfest.ca and check out our, well, now that's really working, check out our ticket line. Very pleased to welcome Arthur Miller. Arthur Miller is Professor of History and Philosophy of Science at University College in London. He earned his BS in Physics at City College of New York and his PhD in Physics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Professor Miller has lectured and written extensively on the history and philosophy of 19th and 20th century science and technology, cognitive science, scientific creativity, and the relation between art and science. Professor Miller is a fellow of the American Physical Society, a corresponding fellow of l'Académie Internationale d'Histoire des Sciences, and a member of the International Academy of the History of Science. He has been an associate editor of the American Journal of Physics and the recipient of fellowships and grants from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, American Philosophical Society. It's going to not in the play tomorrow. American Council of Learned Societies, National Endowment for the Humanities, National Science Foundation, and the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique. Professor Miller was Vice Chairman, Division of History of Physics, American Physical Society for 1983-1984, and Chairman for 1984-1985. He is Director of the International History of Physics School at the Ettore Majorana Center for Scientific Culture in Erice, Sicily. We're delighted to welcome him. Please welcome Professor Arthur Miller.
Well, thank you, Michael, for that very wonderful introduction. And it's a great privilege and honor for me to be here at the Perimeter Institute and lecture at your Einstein Fest. And indeed, the popularity of this festival is was made quite clear to me when in one of my cab rides over today, the taxi driver asked me whether I was going to the lecture tonight at the Perimeter Institute. I said, I am the lecturer. And it's very gratifying to see that a first-class research institute such as this has a keen appreciation for and interest in the history of its subject. And tonight I'm going to discuss the 20th century's most important scientist, Albert Einstein, and its most important artist, Pablo Picasso. I've always found it intriguing that they made their first and perhaps and probably greatest breakthroughs at about the same time. In 1905, Einstein discovered special relativity, and in 1907, Picasso discovered Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. Now, what immediately comes to mind is whether this was serendipitous or not, and I found that the best way to investigate the situation was with parallel biographies. The first decade of the 20th century was the most creative period for Einstein and Picasso. It was an exciting moment in Western intellectual history akin to the Renaissance some 500 years earlier. Change was in the air. Rebels against academic and bourgeois conventions considered themselves to be part of the avant-garde, that intellectual tsunami that was sweeping over Europe. Traditional knowledge was being questioned in art, music, literature, architecture, and in physics. That is to say, classical intuitive ways of understanding space and time. Picasso and Einstein were swept along. At that time, they were not the distinguished elderly figures that we've come to know. Einstein looking like he witnessed the creation itself, and Picasso in his usual photogenic sense. Rather, they were in their 20s, they were unknown, feisty, dirt poor, and prone to getting into trouble. Let me begin by looking at both men's annus mirabilis. In 1905, Einstein was an absolute cipher. It was only through the influence of a friend's father that in 1902, he obtained a position as patent clerk, third class provisional in the Swiss Federal Patent Office in Bern, Switzerland, an intellectual backwater. There, Einstein worked 6 days a week, 8 hours a day. The following year, in 1903, he married his university sweetheart, Mileva Marish, with whom he had had a passionate love affair. They were soulmates. They lived the lives of young German fantasy-ek bohemians. But by the time they were married, Mileva lived in the shadow of her husband, and Albert's interest in her began to wane. In 1903, they moved into a small flat in the city center of Bern. And here is a table on which Einstein may well have written part of the relativity paper, and of course a clock in the background. The following year, their son, Hans Albert, was born, and monetary problems entered. And so it is no wonder that along with monetary and marital problems on his mind, Einstein recalled that it was at the patent office where he did his best creative work. The patent office was his secular cloister, the closest he ever came to heaven on earth. And Einstein's Bern period, 1909, was the most creative of his life. For intellectual stimulation, he had a study group, the core of which was Einstein and two of his pals, Konrad Habeck and Maurice Solovine. They called themselves nothing less than the Olympia Academy and took all knowledge as their province. Einstein also had friends in the patent office, as well as in the Federal Postal and Telegraph Administration, which occupied the lower floors of the building. Now, by 1905, Einstein focused on the nature of light as his principal research problem. But so did just about every other physicist working on the frontier of the subject. What separated Einstein from them? Indeed, even in retrospect, there was nothing to warn us, to alert us to the intellectual outburst that occurred in 1905. On the other hand, almost immediately, Picasso's artistic talent was recognized. But beginning of 1904, when he started his permanent stay in Paris, his good friends were not young artists, but rather young literati, new wave writers, such as André Salmon, Maurice Jacob, and Guillaume Apollinaire. They recognized Picasso's creative force. These men formed the core of Picasso's think tank, and they called themselves La Banda Picasso. Like the Olympia Academy, they were dirt poor, but full of youthful enthusiasm. They shared literally everything. They had nothing to lose. Picasso's atelier was in a ramshackle building on the Butte Hill in Montmartre. Jacob affectionately dubbed it Le Bateau Lavoie, after the laundry boats that lined the Seine. Picasso's Le Bateau Lavoie period, 1904 to 1909, was the most creative of his life. For his money, Picasso got nothing more than four dingy walls, inside of which he froze in the winter and roasted in the summer. Here he is on Place Ravignon, right outside of Le Bateau Lavoie. Everyone complained about the situation, but Picasso worked it to his advantage, meeting new male friends and lots of female friends, too. In particular, Fernand Olivier, the first great love of his life. Fernand had an air of lightness and elegance about her, a curious mind. She had great determination and also some artistic talent as well. With a mass of auburn hair and green almond-shaped eyes and a voluptuous body, she was capable of more than playful flirtations and of turning heads. Here are many Fernands. This is a painting, The Harem, which Picasso did in the summer of 1906 in Gosol. Now, for the first year or so of their relationship, that is until from, say, about spring of 1905 to the end of 1906, she played the part of Picasso's muse. But soon after that, her role can be charitably described as providing negative reinforcement. That is to say, Picasso succeeded despite her. They had a typically tempestuous MoMART relationship. Now, other artists had relationships of that sort and suffered the poverty that was rampant in MoMART. Then what separated Picasso from them, in particular from André Derain, who was Henri Matisse's favorite pupil? Everyone thought that it would be that Derain would make the breakthrough to a highly conceptual and radically new style of art. During March to June of 1905, Einstein moved to a new conceptual style, one based to some degree on a new notion of aesthetics. At 8-week intervals, starting in March of 1905, working at white heat, he produced 3 papers that changed the course of science and the course of nations. And central to Einstein, and one of them was the relativity paper. Now, central to Einstein's reasoning in the relativity paper was a new notion of aesthetics, which he had tried out in the first paper of that series. All 3 papers were published in the same volume of the German physics journal, the Annalen der Physik. In that first paper, Einstein explored the nature of light. And he began the paper straight away by saying that scientists made an unwarranted, profound formal distinction between waves and particles. Why have both waves and particles when you're looking at certain phenomena? Why not have just particles of electrons and particles of light? Einstein used this minimalist aesthetic to great effect in his discovery of relativity theory. And what I have in mind here is this consideration of how electrical dynamos work. Now, Einstein had extensive experience with electrical dynamos. He assessed patents on them while he worked working at the patent office. Now, what do behemoths of this sort, this is a dynamo around 1905, what does this have to do with relativity theory? Well, a lot. Electrical dynamos, which are the basis of the second industrial revolution, produced the power that lit up the night. So people knew they worked, but they weren't quite sure about how they worked. They are based on a phenomenon known as electromagnetic induction, in which, they're based on a process called electromagnetic induction, in which a current is produced in a wire that's in relative motion with respect to a magnet. Now, according to electromagnetic theory, as it was interpreted in 1905, if you ask this observer how the current was produced and this observer how the current was produced, you would get 2 radically different explanations. But that's for a phenomenon which has only one measurable effect, that is to say, the current generated, which can be traced back to a single cause, relative motion. To Einstein, these 2 explanations were a redundancy. Even worse, they're unaesthetic, and Einstein found that to be, in quotes, unbearable. It was, as he wrote in the relativity paper, an asymmetry that was not inherent in the phenomena. Rather, there is no real difference between these 2 explanations. It is only one of viewpoint. Neither observer has the true explanation. It's just a matter of, it's just a matter of perspective, and that's all. This realization led Einstein to discover that the principle of relativity, which was a statement that was exact in the science of motion, had to be exact also in phenomena concerning electricity, magnetism, and light. And all of this due to a minimalist aesthetic. Now, reasoning along these lines, Einstein had to move to new heights of abstraction. In other words, emphasize conception over perception. In 1905, Picasso was also beginning to explore the world in terms of conception over perception and to look to new notions of aesthetics. A factor that impelled him along this route were new wave paintings produced by Derain. These were paintings that pushed conceptual art to its limits at this time. Painters, there's Bathers by Derain and Le Bonheur de Vivre by Henri Matisse. What had also struck, Picasso felt challenged. He felt his own work paled in comparison. What also struck young artists was an exhibition of primitive Iberian art at the Louvre in May 1906. What struck them was that the tribal artist depicted what he knew rather than what he saw. Now, to Picasso, this required some deep thought. And the only way he could do this was to leave Paris with all of its intellectual and painterly pressures and gossip, too. So he took Fernand, went to the town of Gassol outside of Barcelona. That's where he did the painting, The Harem. And Picasso started to produce paintings like Two Nudes. This is a highly conceptualized Iberian art form. And his self-portrait with palette. Here as a clenched fist, he's now going to challenge Derain and Matisse for leadership of the avant-garde. Indeed, at this point in time, Picasso began to take boxing lessons, too. Now, what better way to challenge them than with the most ungenteel theme available, a bordello scene, only with the violence ratcheted up to shocking heights. Picasso embarked on this the bordello project with no muse to guide him. The honeymoon with Fernand was over. He worked frantically and alone. And to make matters worse, comments from friends who saw preliminary sketches were not good. Before him, Picasso saw the solitary figure of Paul Cézanne, who represented to him an exemplar of relentless striving and how to endure incredible isolation in working alone to produce this breakthrough that he was working towards. Picasso formally began working on his bordello painting in March of 1907, and by fall of 1907, he completed what became known as Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. It is an in-your-face confrontation with five whores with the viewer as client. As we look across this expansive canvas, 233 centimeters in width by 244 centimeters in height, we see five demoiselles. The demoiselle on the left is partially clothed. She has an Egyptian Gauguin-esque face and a partially disembodied left arm that's parting a curtain. The two demoiselles next to her are more attractive. They're of Iberian oceanic likeness. The demoiselle on the right is more geometrized. And finally, we have what's known in the trade as the squatter. She's in a grotesquely impossible situation. Back to the picture plane, head turned 180 degrees as if on a swivel, a nose like a wedge of brie, eyes offline and distinctly different, a snout-like mouth, and she's represented simultaneously in full face and profile views. And her face is shockingly hideous compared to the others. She is also the most advanced in geometrical and experimental representation than all of the other demoiselles. And indeed, it's my belief that an understanding of this face is the key to our finding out what was Picasso's realization towards discovering a new aesthetics, the reduction of forms to geometry, which became the hallmark of cubism. In March 1905, Einstein was also working in fanatical isolation, and then he became stuck in his work on relativity theory. The problem concerned the nature of time, and more particularly, how he could represent two events that occurred at the same time, that is to say, are simultaneous, and yet are far apart. It has long been a mystery as to how Einstein solved this puzzle. And in my opinion, the clue lay in papers written by the only other scientist involved with this problem, the great French polymath Henri Poincaré, who, to my surprise, was also of great importance to Picasso. The problem of how time is measured was a hot topic in the French Academy of Sciences, to which Poincaré belonged and contributed, as well as in the Patent Office in Bern, and of course in the Federal Postal and Telegraph Administration. Besides mapping problems, which the French always fancied, there were such problems as weather reporting of widely spread weather phenomena by observers who are also very far apart and who required clocks that read the same time. There was also the issue of standardizing railroad timetables, which was a chaotic situation over long distances in the United States and Canada in particular. And then there was the issue of time on shipboard. The issue boiled down to how to synchronize clocks. Wireless telegraphy was agreed on, procedures had to be set. Just about every other scientist, including Poincaré, became bogged down in a panoply of assumptions concerning what speed light travels through space and how we perceive its effects. Einstein took a different strategy than anybody else. To him, there's no problem with what velocity light travels with. It travels at the velocity of light. And we should leave perception out of the picture. Rather, it's conception that counts. This had enormous ramifications, such as the time registered on a clock depends on the clock's relative motion, and that simultaneity is not an absolute phenomenon, but a relative phenomenon. Namely, two events that are simultaneous with respect to observers at relative rest need not be simultaneous to observers in relative motion. There is no one true view of simultaneity, no one true perspective, just like there is no one true view of electromagnetic induction. This is another hard-won triumph of conception over perception. I now turn to Picasso's work on simultaneity. Picasso's anxiety while working on Les Demoiselles d'Avignon is akin to that suffered by research scientists working on the frontier of their subject, in which the problem that they pose for themselves may not have any solution whatsoever. Now, artists are problem-oriented, and artists like Picasso were willing to take chances. After all, Picasso lived at the center of the debate that swirled about abstraction versus representation. New developments, and that was at the heart of the avant-garde, new developments in technology, science, and mathematics would ultimately make the difference. Technology, airplanes, wireless telegraphy, cinema, bicycles, all changed everyone's conception of space. And photography, from its date of discovery in 1838, everybody thought that photography would be the way to give you an absolutely precise representation of what you see. Well, photographers quickly put pay to that by distortions by means of lenses. X-rays, since their discovery in November 1895, they're considered as nothing less than fantastic. The distinction between two and three dimensions became blurred. What was inside and what was outside became ambiguous. What was opaque became transparent. And indeed, there are all sorts of cartoons of people having to wear lead-like clothes so people couldn't see through other clothes, so men couldn't see through women's clothing. What you saw was not what you got. Artists, young artists, used X-rays as a weapon against figuration, and scientists often used X-rays against positivism. Then there was mathematics. Mathematicians began investigating exotic geometries that were represented in more than three dimensions. These ideas were hotly discussed in Parisian cafes, were reported on in newspapers, which Picasso read, and his think tank kept him informed. Ideas were everywhere. The air was electric in Paris, as you might expect. Picasso's sketchbooks from the autumn of 1906 through 1907 contain a variety of sketches, many hundreds of sketches, some of which would appear in Demoiselles d'Avignon. They're like a scientist's notebooks full of false starts and dead ends. And the most challenging to interpret is the squatter. She appears in Picasso's sketches, winter of 1906 to 1907. Here she is as a Cezanne-esque sort of woman, back to the picture plane, head easily turned, legs spread apart, attempting to attract the attention of a sailor sitting in the center here with an outright show of her sex. In about March, the Demoiselles move away from the influence of Cézanne, Ang, and El Greco, and they become conceptual Iberian forms. And then finally, and a whole academic industry is formed from this question of how Picasso went from many figures to five figures. By May of 1907, Picasso began extreme geometrical experiments, and there appears a remarkable woman, a remarkable figure of a woman who's faceted into interlocking diamonds with kneecaps.
Now, this figure is nowhere like the figures that art students and even artists practice copying from books such as those written by Albrecht Dürer and Leonardo da Vinci. Rather, Picasso obtained a clue to how to construct figures of this sort from a book written by a little-known mathematician, Esprit Giuffre. But Giuffre was very well contacted. One of his good friends was Poincaré. And the treatise is Elementary Treatise in Geometry in Four-Dimensional Geometry. And here one sees figures of this sort. And what Giuffre did was to write down complicated mathematical equations for complex polyhedrons in four dimensions, and then by means of certain mathematical calculations, project them down into the two-dimensional plane of the paper. And what he did also was to project them in various, and rotated them. So he projected them down onto a two-dimensional plane in different perspectives in succession. But how could Picasso and his gang have known about a book of this sort? Well, it turns out that Picasso learned about four-dimensional geometry and how to play around with geometry from an insurance actuary who had a keen interest in advanced mathematics, name of Maurice Poncet. Poncet was introduced into the La Bande à Picasso by his notoriously unfaithful mistress, Alice Géry, who liked hot-blooded Spaniards, and had, in fact, had been a girlfriend of Picasso at the time Picasso met Fernand. Poncet was seen with Picasso's group in cafes, took part in their hashish sessions. It was de rigueur. After every meal, you popped a hashish pill. And also appeared in Picasso's atelier at critical times during May to June 1907. And to give you an idea of what a good buddy Poncet was of La Bande à Picasso, for his 33rd birthday in 1908, Picasso sent him a birthday card. That was on your 33rd birthday, greetings, your friend Picasso. Now, amongst the topics that Poncet lectured over a cafe table to La Bande à Picasso were topics from Henri Poincaré's widely read book, Science and Hypothesis, which had also kept Einstein's think tank, the Olympia Academy, spellbound. And of particular interest to Picasso was Poincaré's suggestion of how to view the fourth dimension. And it goes something like this. We can consider, after all, figures on a two-dimensional surface as projections from the third dimension. So why not consider figures on a three- or two-dimensional surface as projections from the fourth dimension? After all, Poincaré continued, geometricians do it playfully all the time, having Giuffre in mind. Picasso continued, imagine that the different perspectives of one and the same object succeed one another. Now, writings such as Poincaré's were immensely influential on young artists because one of the principal problems of art in the avant-garde was how to represent figures from the fourth dimension on a two-dimensional canvas. Artists considered the fourth dimension to be a fourth spatial dimension. And they talked about the plane of four dimensions as what they called the astral plane. If you can get up into this plane, you would have a god's eye view of a scene. It would be a blooming, buzzing confusion. The only way to make some sense out of it is to project it down onto the two-dimensional canvas. Well, we could imagine Picasso leaning back in his chair at maybe La Panne Agile, and saying, well, why in succession? Why not all at once? The problem was how to do it. And Picasso got down to work. He began further experiments with geometrizing his conceptual Iberian figures. Here, a nose like a wedge of brie appears. And he felt that there was some hope going on in this project, and he began to in June he began transferring sketches such as this, only more advanced, onto his large canvas. But he soon became stuck, and he was also just disgusted with his work and with his private life as well, which was not going well. Fernand was threatening to leave him. He turn his canvas to the wall, and what to do? Well, he went to see his friend Derain, and Derain suggested that Picasso take a walk over to the Ethnological Museum at Trocadero to see the exhibition of African masks. Such as that. Picasso recalled that he was shocked. He had an epiphany, because the exhibition of African masks gave him confidence that he was proceeding along the correct line, the line of conceptual art. Now, what I believe happened next is that, number one, Picasso suddenly, what Poncet had been saying to him suddenly made sense about geometry and about geometrizing. And Picasso then had the brainstorm, the brainwave, the great idea to proceed along the route of extreme geometrization, more than he had ever geometrized before, of conceptual idea, of conceptual art. So, whereas before Trocadero, before he saw African art, Picasso had been experimenting with geometry, after Trocadero, Picasso realized that geometry was just the right language to express the message of conceptual art, while simultaneously realizing a new art form that could take its place beside the magnificent achievements in the avant-garde of science and technology. So in Picasso's hands, the formerly informal language of art became formalized. Picasso got down to work, and his sketches from the end of June on contained strictly geometrical studies. And another important subject is another discovery Picasso made at Casol, the face of his landlord, Joseph Fontevilla. He had drawn in conceptual Iberian form in 1906, or I should say conceptualized Iberian form. This face runs through Picasso's life, runs through his oeuvre, becoming his own as an old man. And what he did, starting in June, was the following. He began to geometrize it. Nose like a wedge of brie, the face flattens. Remember, this was the previous one. Nose like a wedge of brie, face flattens, mouth becoming snout-like, flips the nose 180 degrees across the vertical, adds a hint of hatching. When I'm summarizing here, there's many hundreds of sketches. Adds a hint of hatching for a bit of violence, flips the nose back, and what one has is a face that, after many, many more sketches, becomes a projection from the fourth dimension. That is to say, a simultaneous representation of facial, of front and profile perspectives, not in succession, as Poincaré had suggested. Now, how to put different views together, Picasso had always been concerned with that, particularly after reading Poincaré. Just let me show you one early thought of his. Here's a wash basin from above and from the side, how to put them together. Some people had a more direct route to this, such as in this figure from the Humor magazine, Le Rire, just slap them together. Now, for other clues as to how Picasso discovered Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, let us turn to the vibrant visual culture of Paris, with its technological developments, particularly in photography and cinematography. Now, to Picasso, it's only in the last 15 years that we found that Picasso was an average photographer. And to Picasso, photography was not to be an exact representation of the scene. Rather, it was a playful device. It was a creative device. And Picasso made his experiments, photographic experiments, with tiny glass plates and a tiny camera, which he slapped the glass plates on the back. We call that camera today a box camera. In those days, it was called a detective, because you could sneak it around. And there, we know he mixed his own developer and fixing solutions, and was very much involved. He was always involved in many different art forms all at once. This is one of his earlier, it's a double exposure. It was done in 1901. It's a careful setup, studio setup of works completed and in progress. And here, the great man materializes through a wall. Here, Picasso is playing around with a sense of fantasy and investigating the nature of space as well. Besides photographic experiments, Picasso, like all artists, used picture postcards to help him in framing Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. And of course, paying homage to his ancestors, such as El Greco's Apocalypse. Now, the disembodied left arm of this demoiselle and the impossible position of this demoiselle, known as the floater, is a clue to Picasso's attempts to create a space, a pictorial space, that can support surprising and unexpected movements. And here we are reminded of Georges Méliès, the French cinematographer, pioneer in special effects. Picasso and his gang went to the movies every week in Montmartre. Montmartre was the only place in Paris where there were movie theaters. Going to the movies was an experience in slumming at that time. There was still a question of how deep the light should go dark. And one of Méliès' specialties was the explosion of bodies and reassembling them in weird and often hilarious ways. And in time, as a matter of fact, the more advanced cubism, the synthetic cubism, would involve an explosion of space, such as this portrait, Picasso's portrait of Monsieur Canviller, done in 1910. Now, on another experimental technological track, there were the explorations of Étienne Jules Marais and Edward Muybridge. Marais explored a series of movements on a single frame. This is entitled, not surprisingly, The Fencer. And that gave Picasso an inspiration for his discovery of Cubist simultaneity and for the interpenetration of forms. Muybridge explored a sequence of images on closely spaced frames. Of course, both of these developments would lead to moving pictures. The title of this one is Naked Woman Dropping a Handkerchief and Picking It Up. And what I believe is that what Muybridge's input to Picasso was the idea of setting up a motion picture sequence in five frames of increased geometrization as you move from left to right. Now, to begin to conclude, begin to sum up, any highly creative work of art or science necessarily draws on many different and apparently unconnected disciplines. But I believe that at the moment, that nascent moment of creativity, boundaries dissolve between disciplines, and both artist and scientist think along the lines of a new aesthetic. They begin to think along the same lines, aesthetic lines. And now such highly creative thinking can be likened to a mosaic of many different tiles. Some of them we've discussed today with regard to Einstein and Picasso. One of them is geometry. Geometry was of importance to Picasso at the beginning of his work, and indeed through Demoiselle d'Avignon, but not to Einstein. It would not be until 1907 that the German physicist mathematician Hermann Minkowski realized, with many hints from Poincaré, that a deeper representation of what Einstein had accomplished could be had through a four-dimensional representation, where here, to scientists, the fourth dimension is time. But it's the same. It's an analogous situation with artists, whereby if you could look up into the fourth dimension, into a four-dimensional plane, and see and try to observe a phenomenon from that vantage point, from a God's eye view, you would see blooming, buzzing confusion. Once again, the only way to make sense out of it is to project down onto two dimensions. These are sketches from Minkowski's notebooks. And here one has one time dimension and one spatial dimension. But no one perspective, no one projection is the true or absolute one. How you look at a phenomenon, that's the way it is. Technology was of importance to Picasso in cinematography, photography, and to Einstein it was important in examining electrical dynamos, which gave him a key idea for relativity theory, as well as the situation with railroad timetables, which led him to consider the notion of what is time a bit more. All of this came from his experience at the Patent Office. And science, of course, science was important to Einstein. To Picasso, the notion of X-rays was a key point for him. Now, art historians have a peculiar view of the origins of Cubism. To them, the roots of Cubism are in Cézanne's drawings and African art, and that's it. Don't ask me anything anymore. But that I always consider to be rather peculiar, and something many of them will not talk about. Because how can somebody like Picasso, living in an intellectual, you know, hot box that Paris was, and not realize what was going on in geometry, technology, and science? And indeed, we do know that Picasso realized all the great discoveries in geometry and cinematography and X-rays and ideas were fed to him by his think tank. So these three dimensions are sorely neglected in Picasso's early work. Aesthetics, of course, for Picasso, for both Einstein and Picasso in discovering a new aesthetics. For Einstein, it was important in the way that he introduced aesthetic reasoning into 20th century science. And indeed, whereas in art, aesthetics is to still a great extent subjective. It's in the eye of the viewer. In science, one can test for whether a theory is beautiful, whether it is aesthetic. There are certain mathematical tests you can run on it, and usually beautiful theories are the correct theories. That can be. This is not to say for those many scientists in the audience, you can cook up an extremely beautiful theory which holds its form under all sorts of transformations, and it'll be nonsense. So there has to be some. There are guidelines for creativity. You can't wake up one morning and say, "I think I'll discover a new theory." There has to be an accumulation of knowledge and guidelines in the sense of certain what are called conservation laws that have to be maintained that give you a structure to build a new theory around. Competitiveness, well, not so much for Einstein and special relativity, but certainly for Picasso. And competitiveness in the sense of competing with Biran and Matisse, for example. Sex, well, Picasso was a sexual volcano. And Einstein, from correspondence that's being discovered more every year, he was not too far behind. Sex inspired these people, and these people should not be viewed and evaluated from the viewpoint of the late 20th century and the 21st century. They were men of their times. Philosophy and literature, of course, were Einstein, David Hume, Ernst Mach, Immanuel Kant, Baruch Spinoza were great importance to him. For Picasso, it was a rather crude philosophy, the philosophy of Nietzsche that he picked up in cafes in Barcelona when he was a young man, the strong imposing their will over the weak. This drove his competitiveness as well. Einstein and Picasso both worked on the nature of simultaneity. Their breakthroughs concern realization of the importance of conception over perception, discovery of a new aesthetic, minimalism for Einstein, and reduction of form to geometry for Picasso. That they both worked on the same problem should not be considered as being odd, because they both responded to the avant-garde, the principal problem of which was the nature of space and time. And particularly, the representation of simultaneity. For Einstein, it was a temporal simultaneity. For Picasso, a spatial simultaneity. Let me mention a few more interesting parallelisms. Neither man crossed his respective Rubicon. Einstein never agreed with the next great development in science, quantum physics, nor did Picasso ever delve into abstract expressionism. They both remained classical people. Einstein, a classical physicist, Picasso, a classical artist. One of Einstein's disagreements with quantum theory was that its visual imagery was not the sort of visual imagery that's abstracted from phenomena that we've actually witnessed in the world of sense perceptions. It was something else. It was something that was generated from the equations of the quantum theory. But what I find interesting, most interesting about Einstein, in that he never pursued the logical consequences even of relativity theory. What I have in mind is the most astounding prediction of general relativity of black holes. To Einstein and to just about every other physicist until the 1960s, a black hole was an ugly solution to a beautiful theory. Now we know black holes are everywhere. There's even one upstairs in a bistro. They are these behemoths in the cosmos, inside of which is a once robust star undergoing an eternal collapse. This is how black holes found their way back into the scientific mainstream. It's a complicated and fascinating story, and for details, I recommend my recently published book. Picasso, if you look at Picasso's even most abstract cubist pieces, you can always find fragments of body parts or whatnot on there. And in fact, when things were getting too abstract, when it wasn't clear, it was becoming unclear what was on the canvas, Braque and Picasso began gluing bits of paper, rope, and wood onto it, just to bring the viewer back into the frame of the world in which we live. But I think it's incontestable that just about every art form in the 20th century is either a spin-off of cubism or a reaction to it. Here, as early as 1910, one has explorations into an art form with no form whatsoever. This is the first exhibited abstract expressionist art by Kandinsky. And what's interesting here is that artists, what really interested artists in relativity was not really the fourth dimension, but equals mc squared, because as artists always have unique and interesting interpretations of science, and they interpreted equals mc squared as showing that everything, in fact proving that everything in our world is amorphous, nothing has any form. And so we have Kandinsky's improvisation, Malevich's white on white, remember overhead transparencies. When I would give talks on art using an overhead transparency, I'd just take everything off and just let it project on white, and that's it. And then there's Mondrian's 1917 painting composition, The Reduction of the World to Orthogonal Lines. Going back to, I mentioned that what separated Picasso from Derain. Well, I think what the separation was, the symmetry breaking, one might say, was that Picasso listened to Poncet and Derain didn't. Derain ended up, not too many years later, as really getting into very mediocre art. And what about Poincaré and Einstein? That's an interesting story. Poincaré was the only competitor Einstein had going after a special theory of relativity. It's an interesting situation in which, in 1905, he had two scientists in possession of exactly the same experimental data, and they set up and they represented these data with exactly the same mathematics, yet Poincaré interpreted the mathematics as an advanced theory of the electron, while Einstein interpreted the mathematics as a theory of relativity. What made the difference here is that Poincaré was interested in very, very beautiful and abstract, abstruse mathematical symmetries, which would become more and more important as time went on in the 20th century for elementary particle physicists. But what Einstein was interested in were physical symmetries and asymmetries, such as what the situation was in electromagnetic induction. And he cleared these things up with thought experiments and based on highly visual imagery abstracted from what we see in the world as we move about the world of sense perceptions. Further parallelisms is that neither Einstein's nor Poincaré's great breakthroughs in 1905 and 1907 were interpreted as such. Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon was greeted with embarrassed silence. And in fact, it wasn't exhibited until 1916, wasn't sold until 1925, and then it was practically a giveaway. And then it was sold in 1939 to the MoMA for $28,000, which wasn't even a lot of money in those days. Einstein, what we have to remember here, celebrating this year of science, is that Einstein sat in the patent office for 4 more years after he published the 3 and Allen papers, the one on light quanta, the one proving that atoms actually exist, and the one, the so-called relativity paper, as he put it, because he never liked that name for his theory. And then in they were published in volume 17 of the Annalen, and volume 18 appeared a paper containing results that he had overlooked in the relativity paper E=mc². So it was a big year. But nevertheless, nobody fell off their chairs. Einstein sat there for 4 more years, and he obtained his first position. He obtained his first job as an associate professor in Zurich for his work on the quantum theory of specific heats, not for relativity theory. In 1909, Einstein left the patent office, and indeed he wrote letters around that time to friends saying he had more time for research when he worked 6 days a week, 8 hours a day, rather than when he became a university professor with all that paperwork that was involved. At any rate, and Picasso left the Bateau Lavoie in that year as well. Neither of them were ever able again to focus their attention as they did as young men when they produced their first great works. They went on to become icons of their time. Their attention was drawn elsewhere. They achieved fame beyond fame. But we like to remember them when they were young men. Here is Einstein in 1911 at the first summit conference of physics, the Solvay conference. 11 years before, he was unemployed and apparently unemployable. And here, 11 years later, he stands with the best, and he's their brightest star. Here is Poincaré and Madame Curie trying to look as disinterested as possible in the proceedings. Einstein wrote to his friend Besso at this time that he really got nothing out of this conference. Nobody had anything to teach him. That was quite an assessment. My very favorite photographic self-portrait of Picasso is this one, done sometime between 1914 to 1916 in his spacious atelier in Rue Chauquet. Picasso was a wealthy man at this time. In 1904, even 1905, he was stealing milk from people's doorsteps, and suddenly in 1906 he began to become wealthier and wealthier. And it's a nice testament to the certainty, the confidence in his creative powers at this time. It's a carefully arranged studio setup, as all of these things were. Here is the looming presence of Demoiselle, still unsold, and a timeline runs through to more works that are becoming more and more figurative. The great experiment with cubism is over. Gone are the hallucinatory, dazed, and fiercely competitive looks from his faces from earlier self-portraits. He has become the toast of the Parisian art scene and the master of the avant-garde. And as if in affirmation, a shaft of sunlight shines over his shoulder. Now, there's sometimes disdain for human interactions aside, the stories of Einstein and Picasso inspire. Through incredible self-confidence and perseverance, they managed to produce incredible and intellectual feats under conditions that would have deterred most others. And with no exaggeration, we may say that modern science is Einstein and modern art is Picasso. What I've given you is a very linearized version of a complex and a story that's a rich tapestry. And for further details, I refer you to my book, Einstein Picasso. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Miller. We have time for a few questions. If you have a question, if you would raise your hand and wait until one of the ushers brings you a microphone, we'd be pleased to answer a few questions. Question right here.
But after 1909, Einstein didn't produce anything. Yet his greatest thought was general relativity, which was worked on after 1905, of course, and completed 1915. So he compared special relativity as child's play compared to general relativity. And many scientists today still have a hard time understanding how someone back then could come up with that concept.
Special relativity, there could be no general relativity without special relativity. There could be no really deep quantum theory without special relativity. Special relativity alerted everybody to be on the lookout, that one has to suspend one's knowledge, that one should not trust knowledge obtained through sense impressions. Rather, mathematics is the guide to a world in which there exists extraordinary phenomena, such as the relativity of space and time. So, yes, he said it's child's play. Child's play, one has to take that cum grano saltus, child's play with respect to the mathematics involved. But conceptually, in my opinion, it was a far greater achievement than general relativity. There could be no general relativity without special relativity.
Thanks. At some point, Hilbert had a graduate student who left mathematics to do poetry, and Hilbert's comment was he was not creative enough to do mathematics. So not what one would think of as true creativity these days. So could you comment on that feeling about the creativity of an artist versus the creativity of a scientist and how you feel they interplay and react?
Yes, that's an interesting question. I just came from a three-day conference where we discussed that on 3 days. There are different kinds of creativity. Let me talk non-linearly about this. Einstein had no feeling for art whatsoever. And Picasso had no feeling for music whatsoever beyond Catalan country music. I mean, Picasso is not a listener of Bach. It seems that creativities run in different senses. I think that's about, without going on to another 50-minute lecture, that's about the most I can say. I'll talk to you afterwards. Let me say a few more words. There is an issue these days of the interplay between art and science, of what is art science, art forward slash science or art dash science, is not clear to me and some others. One sees art adorning science. I've seen examples of what's supposed to be art sciences. For example, somebody taking a photograph of a bubble chamber, which to the non-initiated would look like just chicken scratchings on a piece of paper. And it's actually tracks of elementary particles. And what this artist did was to color the tracks, and this is supposed to be art science. What one also sees is, Mandelbrot sets considered to be art. I don't know about that. They're pretty, to be sure. And what is the notion of aesthetics in art and in science and in literature? There are some people that don't accept a concept of aesthetics applied to science. They want it defined. And one can do that, as I mentioned. What I believe, just in a nutshell, is that there will come a day when there will once again be artist-scientists, just like Dürer was an artist-scientist, Albrecht Dürer. Galileo was an artist-scientist, too. Dürer, I can't show it now, but worked towards as realistic as possible representation of a scene using a camera obscura and also using geometry. He was one of the first to do that, to construct figures in projective geometry and so on. Galileo went to the Florentine, attended the Florentine Academy of Art, and it was through the education that he got there that he was able to draw so well what he saw on the moon. And he knew he would have to produce pretty good drawings in order to even begin to convince people that an extraterrestrial object was not a perfect sphere. What I think is going to be the case these days is, in sometime in the future, and is that computer graphics will get to such a high degree, there will be such incredible computer architectures that one can manipulate on a screen, manipulate visual images. There will be a logic of visual images, and you can manipulate visual images as if you were manipulating equations. And in that sense, art and science will once again combine into one field. Now, concerning poetry, there are some fanciful investigations along these lines, which are cute. One doesn't know what depth they have, but people have taken poems and looked at the rhyming pattern in the poems by putting different words into different color and looking at how these occur and whether there's any pictorial pattern to them. In other words, pictorial, you want to, you know, some sort of rhyming, the end of every second, of every alternate line rhymes, might there be some sort of visual aesthetic in this as well. There is great interest in that. There is a Society of Literature, Art, and Science, for example. I mean, to go into science beyond mere science fiction, but I shouldn't say mere science fiction because the fourth dimension was introduced for the first time by H.G. Wells, for example. And the writings of Jules Verne were considered to be interesting to scientists as well. The effect on literature of relativity, there are many effects on it. For example, in James Joyce's Ulysses, you know, telling a tale from different perspectives, all of which add up to the same picture, or like kabuki plays for that matter. So I hope I sort of answered your question. If you're around afterwards, we can talk some more about it. But it's certainly something that's of great interest these days. And it's nice that it is because there's a movement towards interdisciplinarity, which is prevalent in many universities. There's a big problem with that in the way universities are structured. It's difficult to have a Department of Interdisciplinary Studies. It's also not a very good thing to produce a student with a PhD in interdisciplinary studies because that will assure him or her of forever unemployment.
We'll take one more question. There was a question up there.
You talked about the very sexually active individuals, and you also alluded to the deterioration of the relationships between Picasso and his lover and Einstein and his wife. And is it possible that it was really the woman that made the inductive leap that started them on their careers?
I don't know what you mean by an inductive leap, but certainly at first, Maleva was an inspiration to Einstein, and certainly Fernand an inspiration to Picasso. Einstein was a smart kid before he met Maleva. We know that. And there are also the letters that they exchanged. Unfortunately, Einstein destroyed most of the incoming from Maleva. There's outcoming that has been that I'm sure you're all acquainted with. I think that it is not the case that Maleva had anything to do with special relativity theory. Things had degenerated by that time, by 1905. And the relativity paper is the only paper where Einstein acknowledged anybody, and that was his friend Bessel. The letters, there are some very interesting letters that Einstein wrote to Maleva of his struggling with what he called the electrodynamics of moving bodies. This was written in 1899. That would be the title of the relativity paper. But what seems to be the case when one looks at genius in general, and these people in particular, that they were like vampires. They sucked out mental energy from people around them. And they often did their best work when they were treating people, especially women, badly. A hallmark of both Einstein and Picasso and many other highly creative geniuses, this is genius with a capital C, these are people that discover problems to be solved. They don't solve existing problems and win their Nobel Prizes from that, which is all fine and good, too. But these people discover problems. And after all, if you're going to talk about a genius scientist who made great discoveries, well, where did the problem come from? That's something that's often left out of this whole situation. They hunkered down, so to speak, at that moment when they were doing, when they made their nascent creative moment, they worked alone. they squeezed out everybody out of their mind because they thought about a conservation of mental energy. You just have so much energy, and once you're focusing on the problem, you're on the verge of solving the problem, then you cannot have any thoughts, certainly any thoughts of passion or human feeling in mind. And they went through life like that. Everybody came back for more. Nobody complained. It was a great honor to be in their general vicinity. They had great pulling power, one might say. Did that sort of answer you?
Okay, if you would like to join us now for the even less formal part of the evening, please come up to the Black Hole Bistro on the fourth floor. Arthur Miller will be there, and we can pursue the discussion there, so please do join us. I would like to thank you very much, Arthur, for joining us this evening.